From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Mohammed El-Shenawy, Middle East reporter in VOA's English division. Our special guest on this edition of the program is General William Kip Ward, a retired general in the U.S. Army and the inaugural commander of the United States Africa Command, also known as AFRICOM. Created in 2007, AFRICOM is responsible for all U.S. defense and security activities on the African continent and its island nations. Prior to commanding AFRICOM, General Ward was the deputy commander of the U.S. European Command. He is a decorated combat veteran and holds a master's degree in political science. General Ward's 40-year career in the U.S. Army has taken him on tours around the globe, including Korea, Egypt, Somalia, Bosnia, Israel, and Germany. Under the George W. Bush administration, General Ward served as the U.S. Security Coordinator for Israel and the Palestinian Authority in 2005. Currently, he is the President and Chief Operating Officer for Centel Corporation, and that's an engineering company supporting the U.S. government with electromagnetic capabilities and sensor integration. Well, as the latest attacks in Brussels, Istanbul, Paris, and San Bernardino attest, terrorist networks, particularly al-Qaeda and ISIS, also known as Daesh, are expanding their deadly operations across an arc of instability that exists without borders. The key question is whether there are any short- and long-term strategic policies and actions that can more effectively combat multiple threats to the world order. We'll talk with General Kip Ward about how to best combat violent extremism, particularly as it relates to North and Sub-Saharan Africa. We'll talk with him about the threat, particularly from al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, al-Shabaab in Somalia, and, of course, the Nigerian-based terrorist group Boko Haram, among other related issues. And General Kip Ward joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. General, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
And as always, delighted to welcome my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawy.
Thank you.
Well, General Ward, I know you are now retired. Nonetheless, we'd like to get your insights from your long career. And under your leadership at AFRICOM, what did you do to help combat the terrorist threat?
Well, thanks, Carol. And I'm, again, happy to be here as a part of the program. As we established AFRICOM, one of our primary objectives was to cause our activities in Africa to be activities in support of the overall achievement of stability across the continent by working with and through our partners. As a military command, our predominant focus was with the African security forces of the various nations, but to be sure we understood the implication of those actions as it pertained to other factors that would lead to a more stable environment. And we tried to do that by getting to know our partners well, understanding their perspectives, and then doing things in complementary ways to help achieve stability for all.
Quick follow-up on that. I remember in the beginning, there was some controversy among African nations over the creation of AFRICOM. In your view, have those suspicions died down since then? And how would you rate the effectiveness of AFRICOM?
I'm very confident that those suspicions have died down, largely a result of the actions that we took. As we stood up AFRICOM, I spent a lot of time, along with other members of my team, explaining to our friends on the continent exactly what the command was, but as importantly, what it was not. And so the fears that were there with respect to a recolonization of the continent, garrisoning and stationing of large numbers of forces, that never materialized. It did not materialize, was not in the plan to be the part of what we were doing. And therefore, our actions demonstrated that what we said was in fact the case. And the acceptance of the command, I believe, is universal. Certainly, there are those that would still find some fault, but not in any overall way. And I believe the command has established itself very firmly and is welcomed across the continent.
And now, what is your assessment of the current status of terrorist threats, particularly in North Africa and the Sahel?
It's dangerous, it's frightening, and it's something that we all have to be very much concerned about with respect to the actions that it does to those who are directly impacted, but also the implications for global activities and global instability because of what's going on in the Sahel and in North Africa.
I'm going to turn to my colleague, Mohammed, to drill down further in that regard.
General Ward, how serious is the expansion of the so-called Islamic State fighters in Libya?
The situation in Libya presents a serious problem for all of us because of the lack of an effective government in Libya at the current time and the plethora of weapons as a result of the Gaddafi regime that were made available to these groups. That presents a very serious problem to the region, the neighbors of Libya, as well as because of the global threat that it poses to all of us. And so that situation is something that we all need to be concerned about and be paying particular attention to with respect to the movement of foreign fighters in and out of Libya, the movement of weapons out of Libya that would be used in other places in the region, but also around the world.
That brings me to a second question. There are signs that ISIS in Libya is getting some sort of allegiances from other terrorist organizations in Africa like Boko Haram. How would such connection increase the security threats in the region?
I believe any time these criminal terrorist groups come together and collaborate, it increases the collective threat that they pose. And so as you have proclamations by Boko Haram of an alliance with ISIS, I believe that is something that we all should be concerned about because it does heighten the threat that they pose as they share ideas, as they share varying other methods that would be used to inflict terror in the region, but also around the world. So I believe that those allegiances and alliances of those terrorist groups and activities poses certainly an increased threat to us all.
But so far, most of the effort is focused on counter-terrorism measures security-wise. What's your vision for a comprehensive strategy to counter the rising tide of terrorism in Africa?
Countering terrorism is more than just a single-pronged approach that's required. Countering terrorism has with it the notion that it has to be attacked from a multiple areas, multiple arenas. Clearly, the security approach is an important one. It's a critical one. Those who would do harm to innocent people, their ability to do that has to be removed. And to do that requires security forces, it requires security apparatuses, it requires effective intelligence collection apparatus that can determine where they are, where they operate, prevent them from having the support that they require in order to continue to operate. And so you have to do things to limit, to restrict, to deny their ability to conduct their actions. But in addition to that, those conditions that exist that would spawn areas or locations that would be favorable to terrorist activities, that also has to be addressed. And in that regard, there are other activities that must be conducted to address the threat of terrorism. It may not be security measures, but maybe things that impact security, shortages of food, other economic activities, health concerns, educational concerns, infrastructure concerns, things that normal everyday people, wherever they may live, have a concern about, having those things also being addressed to make those areas less conducive to accepting terrorists in their midst.
We'll have more in just a minute. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back to Press Conference USA with our special guest, General William Kip Ward, retired general in the U.S. Army and former commander of AFRICOM. Well, General Ward, let me follow up on Mohammed's question and your answer about some of the reasons that lead people to violent extremism, the conditions. What, in your view, are the core reasons behind so much violent extremism that we see in the world today, from the Middle East to North Africa? What is needed beyond these strict counterterrorism measures in dealing with the causes? What lessons have you learned in all your years, whether in the Middle East or North Africa, about other measures that need to be taken besides militarily trying to defeat these groups to truly prevent their spread and appeal?
Well, thanks, Carol. For me, having been in, as you indicated, as you introduced me, in places around the world where disadvantaged populations exist, disadvantaged either because of war, disadvantaged because of conditions that don't allow them. And I'll use a term that I kind of like because I'm a soldier. But when I was a young soldier, that was a term that we would use to be all you can be. And creating conditions that would allow folks, wherever they may be, to see a vision that I call a horizon of hope, to have the hope that tomorrow will be better than today. And so in that regard, where you don't create conditions, whatever they may be, and however modest they may be, that will allow someone where they are in their homes to say that tomorrow may be better than today, then you have the potential for discontent to exist. And that term horizon of hope came out of my time in Bosnia, when I was in the Balkans. But having something in place such that the people see for themselves that they have a better hope for tomorrow, this horizon of hope. And then along with that, how those who are governing govern such that the people see that their government is acting in their best interest. Not necessarily giving everything, but in an overall sense, acting in a more effective way, in a way that is less corrupt as opposed to being more corrupt, acting in ways that the people see their government working on their behalf more rather than not. And I believe when you factor those things together with a security environment, you reduce the conditions that would be conducive for terrorist activities to develop, because the people themselves will be more inclined to move away from it.
Well, I think you put your finger on a very important point, which is governments acting in the best interests of their populations. But as we know, from Mali to Nigeria to Syria, we're not seeing that. Now, let me qualify that on Nigeria, just had a very successful election. But these things take time. The socioeconomic conditions, particularly in northern Nigeria, are such that Boko Haram got traction, evidently, in the north. How can the United States or international organizations press upon governments, you know, who are very covetous of their sovereignty, to change, you know, some of their policies that could address the economic and political and social grievances that often drive young people to join these terrorist organizations out of a sense of desperation?
You're absolutely correct. It doesn't happen overnight, and it requires a sustained commitment on the part of the global community, candidly, because these are global concerns. It's the role of the global commons, I believe, nations, regional organizations, global organizations that have an interest in stability. A notion of sustained engagement, I believe, is what's required. As we established Africa Command, one of our principles was we would try to ensure that we were involved in sustained security engagement. And again, sustained doesn't mean necessarily large numbers, great resources, but things that are meaningful at the time to the impacted populations. For us, engaging with military forces such that, you know, there was a relationship established. Mm-hmm. You know, you get to understand, you get to know, you build confidence because of a sustained relationship over time. And as those relationships evolve and develop, that confidence exists. You understand each other better. It's a two-way street. And so the ability to transfer ideas, if you will, has a better chance to take hold in an environment where there's trust and confidence because you have gotten to know your partner over time, your friend over time, and there's a trust there. You won't always agree, and that's okay, but you at least develop trust and you're willing to listen and understand and learn from each other. And so this notion of sustained engagement, be it sustained security engagement, sustained developmental engagement, sustained diplomatic engagement, but all of those have to be in place, I believe, and over time, those are things that are required to move ahead.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is General William Kip Ward, a retired general in the U.S. Army and former commander of AFRICOM. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Mohammed El-Shanawi, Middle East reporter in VOA's English division. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Adam Muhammad from Kano, Nigeria. If you'd like to hear your name on the show, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Well, now a question for my colleague Muhammad.
General Ward, how crucial is to deal with the false ideology adopted by extremist groups exploiting Islam to justify their terrorist acts?
I believe just as narratives that are false and irrelevant, untrue, exist, narratives that tell the true story ought to also be available to people. And so I think dealing with that narrative in ways that are effective, that are relevant to those who would listen and hear the message, that has to be a part of the dynamic. So it is important that there's a narrative that's developed so that people hear an alternative. They hear a perspective that's reflective of the truth from the standpoint of those who would see it in a different way, present a story, present a picture that's different than what might be out there being delivered by those who would hijack whatever it is that's being hijacked. So a narrative is important. A narrative is part of this notion of providing hope, because in that narrative that counters what the narrative being presented by violent extremists, you get a different perspective that you can latch onto.
But how would you explain the appeal of violent ideologies, whether of ISIS, Boko Haram, Ansar al-Sharia, or Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb?
Well, when you can't see another option, or you have no other option presented to you, or nothing is in front of you that gives you an alternative, then that could be one of the ways. There are clearly others, and I may don't profess to be the expert on them all, but clearly a part of the notion of, you know, health, education, development, security.
Governance also.
Governance. If you have this, I call, again, this horizon of hope. When folks see for themselves something tomorrow better than today, then they're more likely to reject those things that would seem to be not relevant to what they would want to do or be doing. As a young boy, my father and mother provided me a horizon of hope because they cared for me. They provided a route for me through education, through some measure of health, of caring. And when you provide that, and that was for me wherever I was, and it varies globally. You know, wherever you are, your requirements are different based on history, culture, the things that are important to you in your environment. So you have to understand the environment and then those things that are important to people where they are, not imposing any standards on them that's not relevant to their condition, but taking advantage of what is meaningful to them from a cultural perspective, a historical perspective. And when you address those things that are important to them and they can see progress being made, even if it's small progress, those certainly are counter effects to being susceptible to something that would be extremist. And you have to provide a narrative to support it, then you have to take action that would, in fact, reinforce the narrative.
Mm-hmm. General Ward, with respect to the growth of ISIS in recent months, years, I'd like to get your perspective on perhaps the role, inadvertent or not, of countries, even the United States, with respect to how we can roll this back. Some say that the United States should have left a troop contingent in Iraq, even though there was an agreement with the then Maliki government and the United States that the troops would leave in, I think it was 2011. Again, this isn't the sole reason, but many are saying there are things that the United States and the international community could have done maybe to deter the growth of groups like ISIS. Look at the Syrian war, some say inaction on the part of the international community when a red line is drawn and then not enforced, or groups back the Friends of Syria and then actually, whether diplomatically or militarily, the support is not given. In this case, this would have been the Free Syria Army, although we do acknowledge many attempts were made to help the opposition. So these things fester. And then you have on the one side the brutal Assad government, and you have the growth of ISIS. And as long as the Assad government exists, you're going to have more and more people joining ISIS who feel disenfranchised, who feel enraged at his behavior vis-a-vis the predominantly Sunni population and just vis-a-vis his population. So how do you stop this vicious cycle?
Well, it's one that's not easily stopped. It's one that requires resources from the global community. It requires commitment on the part of the sovereign nation that's involved. To say how do you stop it, you have to be committed to stopping it in a multitude of ways, from engaging at levels that make a difference to the impact of people, to being involved in your understanding of the environment in ways that we sometimes don't quite have. And so knowing what's going on, knowing the history of a region, knowing the implications of all the factors that go into a society, from geography to demographics, you know, understanding that so when you take actions and make decisions, you're making them cognizant of these things that are resident in the area in which you're dealing. What works in one part of the global commons may not work in another part of the global commons, so you have to adapt it so that it's relevant to where it is. And sometimes we don't quite understand what goes on in a nation well enough as we take action. You never have it fully there, but you always work to have a better, more clear understanding. So you're listening a lot. You're listening to the people who live there. You're listening to what's important to them. Obviously, you take your own perspectives into account, but you meld those to come up with a decision. That's the best. Won't be perfect, but that could be the best for long-term solutions. And then you are committed to it. You sustain it. You don't do it for a day or two. It's a commitment that's required to be in place over time.
What do you make of the perception of some people in the Middle East, leaders and others, who say that they feel that the United States is to some extent withdrawn from them, and they feel that the United States is trying to divert its resources and attention to other areas of the world, the Asia Pacific, and they feel to some extent abandoned? Do you hear that as well, and is there any basis for that?
Obviously, if they're saying that, they have some basis for it, so I wouldn't judge or attempt to prejudge why it would be said. But I would note that, you know, the United States is more than just a military power. It's an economic power. We have a business community in the United States that would love to engage globally in places where there are markets, there are resources, there's access to capital. And so our engagement is a function of what goes on in any geographic area. It could be military engagement, but it's also diplomatic engagement, but it's also its economic developmental engagement. And so the United States has many ways in which it can engage. And just because we're not engaging in one aspect of these things doesn't mean that other avenues aren't also available. But as we do that, we also have to be cognizant of the fact that all of these must be working to some degree for progress to be realized. And so when a statement is made by someone that we haven't engaged, again, it's perspectives they have, and it may be reality, but it may not be the totality of what's going on insofar as it our overall engagement and all the things we have available as a nation.
Well, turning back to Africa and the threat from Al-Shabaab, you know, I saw a headline recently in the newspaper, Somalia's dysfunction allows a resurgence of Al-Shabaab. What do you do about this trend of, you know, we can kill them, the terrorists, with drones, we can try to corral the security forces and with lots of technical assistance, money and so on, but we're back to where we started.
Yeah, that's the point exactly. It's more than that. That is clearly an essential part of the dynamic, but it's more than that. And this notion of effective governance has to be there, taking root to some degree, infighting that may exist. And that comes from the people themselves. So there has to be a commitment to that. Sometimes parochial interests take root over national interests for the people at large. And those are things that, you know, the local populations have to take charge of, take ownership of, and make a difference in. Likewise with the notion of the development, the infrastructure, making strides, and then it can be built upon for other progress to occur. So they all have to be at work, and they all have to be moving it forward to some degree, at some pace. It won't be even, it won't be perfect, but to some degree, at some pace.
Do you see something missing with respect to combating the threat from Al-Shabaab? You know, we hear sometimes that security forces, particularly the Kenyan forces, maybe are overly aggressive, trying to root out communities, Somali communities in Kenya, and then because of these heavy-handed tactics, very decent people feel, you know, very disengaged, disenfranchised, and then they are susceptible to going to groups like Al-Shabaab.
Yeah, we have to be concerned about that. I mean, we have activities going on where the nature of the activity can create circumstances like this. But when that happens...
Blowback.
Correct. But when that happens, you have to take steps to correct it. Acknowledge it, if necessary, apologize for it, and then take steps to demonstrate that that's not how we would typically operate or how the force would typically operate. And you take steps to do your best to ensure it from happening again, to be sure.
How does military overreaction to terrorist groups contribute to more violence like what happened in Sinai?
And again, as I said, when that occurs, you acknowledge it and you take steps to demonstrate that that's not the accepted practice or procedure, and you're doing things to keep it from happening again. Will that always be guaranteed? No. But are you demonstrating a willingness, a desire, and an intent for that not to be the case, and you do it such that the people see that there is a commitment to actions that are appropriate, measured, and acceptable with respect to dealing with the situation. Sometimes you look at it and you see it from a different point of view, but you just continue to do the best you can, you know, being forthright, being deliberate, presenting an honest evaluation as best you can based on the information that you have, and you move ahead.
But to create this horizon of hope you talked about, what role do you envision for the U.S. and the international community in terms of improving economic situation, achieving better governance in countries that are witnessing a rise in violent extremism?
That's a great question, and it's exactly because of the partnership that you have to create. And again, it's not the complete role of the country that would offer and contribute some resources. The receiving country has responsibility there as well. From transparency, whatever resources are received, transparency in their use, transparency in their application such that the impacted populations receive the benefit of that, but also so that it's not just a handout, it's something that will help create an environment where people are in a better position to do for themselves as well. And that has to be a part of the construct. And I believe the role that the United States has, the role that the European community has, the role that the global community has in all of that is there. Doing it in conjunction with individual nations, but also doing it in conjunction with the regional alliances that are important. Because again, in this environment, the region impacts. You know, these borders are porous, and so you do things regionally as well as with individual nations because of the ability of terrorists to transcend these porous borders without any inhibitions at all. And so if you aren't doing things regionally and cooperating and from your intelligence, from your infrastructure development, those things are also important to address this whole notion of creating this horizon of hope for people where they live.
And lastly, General Ward, with respect to creating this horizon of hope, as you eloquently spoke about, in addition to the security measures, you know, militarily trying to defeat these extremist groups, in addition to addressing their economic and social grievances, which often lead many to join groups like al-Shabaab or al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb or ISIS, Boko Haram, what about prevention efforts? We note that there was a two-day conference in Geneva sponsored by the United Nations in which the UN Secretary General outlined a four-point plan focused on youth in particular. What more can the United States in particular do, in your view, and of course the international community as well, to prevent people, you know, from joining these groups? You know, what concrete measures do you think we could take in a concerted way, and how important will that be?
Listening to the youth and countries that I've visited, what's important to young folks here in America are important to young folks around the world. They want to be educated. They want to know that what they say matters. Someone's listening to them. Not that someone is doing everything they say, but someone's listening to them. They want to see that if they go to college or get an education, that there's some potential for a job in the future. And so for the United States, again, nations are sovereign. So it's not as if the United States or any other nation can go inside of a nation and just do things to direct. But through engagement, through establishing relationships across myriad perspectives, of myriad areas, you then create this atmosphere that young people see that I can achieve something else. And you provide examples of that. And you use historical examples of nations where things have occurred in a positive way, where nations, where youngsters, young people have seen folks who are like them achieve success in legitimate ways. And so I think for the United States, reinforcing these sorts of things, reinforcing relationships, reinforcing the commitment to relationships, reinforcing our commitment to be engaged such that our partners know that we're going to be there. Those are things that young people can see as a reason for sticking with it, not giving up, if you will. Might there be some number that regardless will still, again, most likely so. But the vast majority would not do that, and they would say, okay, I think I have a chance here, and I'm going to give it my best.
General William Kip Ward is a retired general in the U.S. Army. He's former commander of AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command. Well, General Ward, thank you very much for taking time to come in and share your terrific insights.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Wagner Roberts. And joining me on the program was Middle East reporter in VOA's English division, Mohammed El-Shanawi. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.